Commissioner Blunt, but they're all only just hearing.
And so we had a super short one.
The House Committee on Revenue for March 2nd, 2015 will come to order. Thank you all for being here today. We're going to open a public hearing on the two bills with a similar subject matter, House Bill 2927 and House Bill 2883. With that, we'll open the public hearing. Okay?
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, we have two bills in front of you about high-cost disabilities account, raising the amount, grant amount, to $36 million from $18 million per year. And I have a little background material. We could do that a little later.
A little later. That might be good. All right. Great. Senator Gelser. Oh, and Representative McLean, thank you. Representative McLean, please. Okay. Right. Welcome back to the House.
Good to be back in my favorite committee. Although you all moved, except for Tobias. Representative Reed, sorry. Tobias is eternal.
Oh, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you very much for allowing us to come in and speak at the beginning of the committee today. And as has been pointed out by your staff, we are here to talk about House Bill 2927. And to be concise, I'm going to stick to my notes. And my name is Representative and I am from House District 29, which is Western Washington County, and represent part of Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. I'm really happy to be here today to talk a little bit about something I know you're all very familiar with, and that is the high-cost disability account, which was actually established in 2003. And it is a grant account, and it's designed to basically reimburse a school district who has a resident pupil with a disability whom the eligible cost in the school district is providing is over $30,000 or exceeds $30,000. That's the floor. The legislature appropriates funds each biennium, and if the funds are lower than the actual claims, that amount reimbursed is prorated. Briefly, I just want to say that House Bill 2927 would double the amount of money appropriated to the high-cost disability account, as pointed out by your staff, from $18 million to $36 million each fiscal year for the next biennium. This concept came really directly to you from the Task Force on School Funding, which was basically during the interim, and it resulted from House Bill 2506 in the 2013 session. The account has been held steady at $18 million since 2007 and 2008 school year, where the claims against the grant have climbed much higher than the allotment of over $44 million in the 2012-2013 school year. This has resulted in a rate of reimbursement at about 40% to the districts. Doubling the monies appropriated to the account will increase the reimbursement to around 80%. I want to share an example, and this example is from my district, where in the year 2012-2013, the Forest Grove School District had $3.6 million in eligible claims against the grant program. Due to reimbursement rates of 40%, the shortfall in funding for that school year was nearly $2 million, which comes then directly out of the general fund dollars that the Forest Grove School District gets. I want to point out that out of all of the 197 school districts statewide, all of us in all of those districts want to provide full services for their high need and special service children, not only because it's a federal mandate, but also because it's the right thing to do. I want to really support this particular piece of legislation because I believe it will help all school districts, it will help all students, and it will allow those general fund dollars to be used in all school classrooms and helping all students, not just the special needs students or the special services. And I'm happy to answer questions after the panel is finished.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I am the state senator from Corvallis and Albany. I'm here today to support House Bill 2927. The high-cost disability grant is a very important protection for school districts in meeting the needs of the students in their districts. As Representative McLean said, this is not something that we do because it's a mandate. This is something we do because these are our students. These are Oregon students, and all Oregon students, regardless of the severity of their disability, are entitled to a free and appropriate public education. So regardless of the high-cost disability grant or federal funding, these are our children that have a right to go to public school every day. By doubling the size of this grant, we can provide better reimbursements to districts to strengthen the services that they offer. The one caution that I would add, and my hope from the Department of Education, is that another way to make these dollars go further is to make sure that we really are paying attention to how those dollars are spent. And that means ensuring that Medicaid claims are made when they need to be made, providing districts the ability to do that, and also comparing like students to like students from district to district. There are some students that in one district may be a $35,000 student, and yet in another district it may be an $18,000 student, and yet the $18,000 student does better. We could do this by more carefully looking at the receipts and the expenditures. One example of this, a couple of years ago, we worked on an issue with the Providence Child Center in Portland Public Schools. We received a spreadsheet from Portland Public Schools talking about the estimated cost for each student. I worked with the families and got all of those IEPs. What was on the IEPs did not match up with what those estimated costs were. So I think that that is a role that the department can play. In some cases, there were many thousands of dollars of differences in that, and being accurate means these dollars are spread more effectively and more broadly across the state, and you have a higher value on each dollar that you claim.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative, what's it?
I was wondering how many children statewide this would apply to the 36, if we increase it to 36 million.
I don't think I have that. I don't believe I have that data. I would appreciate it if the administrator has that for us.
Yes, I do have that material. The
reality, of course, while he's looking it up, the reality is that it doesn't change the number of students who are eligible. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It simply increases the percentage of what this district spends
right.
that will apply to those extra costs.
I was just wondering how many there were.
Ah, I get you.
So, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, based on ODE estimates for school year 13-14, we have 2,800 students mm-hmm. qualified, and the total cost, claimed cost, was $42 million, but $18 million was available to distribute. So, ending up with 42% reimbursement rate. That's for 13-14 year.
And that material's in our.
Okay.
In OLIS, isn't
okay.
it?
Yes.
Yes, the grant, under the grant history. Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So because there's so many elements in the school fund, and this in particular, can you walk me through again? I'm just trying to get a stronger sense of kind of at which points the limits come in. Like how much of the fact that people only get reimbursed on 42% is that because they have more claims that are over 30,000, or how much of it is that 40. The 18 million is divided into at the end of the biennium, the 18, you wait and see how many there are, then you divide it, and then you get that number. So I guess, could you help me out with that?
I think I can do it, and
please.
If I can't, you help me out. Okay,
I think you'll have it just fine.
Basically, right now the grant program only allows you basically to claim 40%. That's what we've set, you know, that they can claim 40%. Forest Grove had 3.6 million in claims, and they get 40%, or the administrator was saying closer to 42%. And with this new program, they would have their same claims. They would have 3.6 or 4 million, and they would get to claim up to 80%. So it just simply changes the amount that's available in the grant program from 18 million to 36 million.
Okay. And can I follow up? And that percentage, is that does that percentage come from a look back at the biennium before and how many applications there were, and then it's divided?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, a good way to look at it would be, so we just heard that there were $42 million in claims last session and only $18 million available. So $18 million was 40% of that $42 million. So 40% of every dollar claimed is what you could receive. So on every claim, on every high-cost disability claim, they're not prioritized where some get 50% and some get 20%. It's just we know that the available resources are 40% of what the claims were, and therefore for every dollar claimed, you get that same amount back.
Okay. Maybe you're going to correct this for me, but I'm just going to ask one more time, because I completely understand what you're saying, and I'm still trying to get to how do we come up with that 42%? Is it based on a look back from the biennium before?
So I think the ODE is here to help us.
Well, I can answer
everybody
that.
Everybody else understands.
I can answer that question. The statute allows $18 million to be spent. There were claims for $42 million. If you compare those two numbers, one is 40% of the other.
Okay.
And that's the portion that gets paid.
That's
so it's a simple,
so it happens
it's
to
a
be,
very simple yeah. arithmetic yeah. problem, and it's because the amount that's available to be spent in this category is the $18 million that the statute says.
And Mr. Chair,
yes,
Representative
please.
Smith-Warner, it's based on the actual claim. So you use the word look back. The district pays first, and then they get paid back later. So it's not prospective. It's money that's already been spent.
Right. It's reimbursement.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
And that's how we know what the percentage is because we know we have $18 million, there are this many requests, and then we can only pay so much. And if I can just clarify as well, you cannot claim more than $30,000 per student?
No.
$30,000 is the floor.
Yes.
And so it's up above the $30,000. So the school district is
Thank
paying
you.
The first $30,000.
For each student
for each
or
student,
overall?
For each student.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. And, of course, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we open up both bills concurrently, or are we
yes.
just hearing the
yes,
first
Yes, we opened both of them. And if you have a question on the other one, go ahead and ask
Well,
it.
They're actually they're similar, but they're
different.
They're
not identical, though, are
right.
they? That's
and
right.
2883, I think, gets to what you were just referring to, is it increase it expands the $18 million to $36 million, as does your bill, but then it also raises the threshold or the floor, if you will, to $40,000. So anything open above $40,000 would be covered with a greater pool of money to work with. I support the concept, you know, and there's another avenue or another benefit to students, I think, in this, in that I'm a big supporter of interdistrict transfers. You know, I carried House Bill 3681 back in 2011. But one of the impediments for districts engaging in opening their borders is they're not quite sure what sort of potentially high-need students they might get in a lottery or something. But having a better funding, more guaranteed base funding for that, I think would open up more opportunities for students to, you know, be able to go from one district to the next as their needs are better met. So I support what you're doing.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm really glad that you mentioned that. We've made a number of changes to the law over the last couple of years. In the interdistrict transfer law, students would be eligible for the high-cost disability. And in both interdistrict transfer and open enrollment, a district may not deny enrollment to a student based on their disability or their cost.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Could you describe when the money goes to the school, then what do they do with it per student?
As our senator pointed out just a moment ago, they pay it out
right
out front, and so the money goes back into their program for paying for those students. And so, you know, basically they pay it out first, we reimburse at 40%. With this piece of legislation, they would be reimbursed to 80%. But it's used to go back to their programs and their care.
And Representative or Representative Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, what these students might look like, for instance, would be a medically fragile student that perhaps requires one-on-one nursing care throughout the day. That will bump that amount up past $30,000. A student that has kind of high-intensity behavioral needs that may need additional supports during the day. A student that needs Braille transcription and a lot of additional types of materials or assistive technology, that can make those needs. But the expenditures are based on the IEP, which is written by that team for each individual child.
Okay, I have a follow-up.
Please, yes.
Sort of just a comment. Are the students cognizant of where they're at? I'll just tell you why I asked this. I did some student teaching some years ago, and I had a student who was in a regular classroom who was fetal alcohol syndrome and unaware that he existed. He was tied in a chair and was blind, deaf, and would periodically scream. And they didn't have an aide or anything for me in there, and I was a substitute, and I had no idea really how to handle this. The other little kids went over and helped because they were used to it, but this child was not cognizant of anything that I know of. He was one of a family of six that it happened to. And so I was just wondering, does this include those children too?
Yes, you may. Thank you. Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, thanks for the question. All students, regardless of the type of disability that they have, are subject to our compulsory public education law, and all of them as a civil right have the right to go to school. So it does include them. I think sometimes, you know, we all have different ways of communicating. So there are individuals that might have a sensory disability that may be blind or deaf or both, or make sounds that are loud or unusual. A lot of times those behaviors or sounds, those are all different types of communication. So sometimes I think the way that we perceive people may be different based on our own experience than how they experience the world. So I think most people are cognizant of where they're at. I think another example that I would give, I am the parent of a child with an intellectual disability, and it's been important to us as he's been in school from preschool to have him mainstreamed in regular classrooms, and we've had a lot of pushback to that. Could he actually benefit from this? And he is an individual that now loves history, loves literature, loves civics. As he sat in the classrooms, we had teachers ask if he understood what was happening or there was a benefit to him being there, and he does. I think one of the times I could see that was in our community. There was a fire that was set to a local mosque, and we went to a vigil that was held, and my son said, it reminds me of what happened during the Holocaust when they broke the windows of the stores. So clearly he listened and he understood in a way that nobody would have expected that he would. I wouldn't have guessed that he did. So I think that's why these resources are important, that we see that potential that we all have, even if it's not obvious from the outside.
Mr. Chair, might I add?
Please,
to that?
Yes.
In the school district where I have taught for a long time, 39 plus years, we had students that were in two or three different programs, and this is a wide scope, you know, of fragile special services. And it was amazing how much some of the students grew. That's what I loved about what you just heard. In 4 years when they were there, how much they interacted with other students from the regular school population and or wanted to be part of the activities that they were doing. And they made that possible many times, even if they were on a, you know, in a wheelchair or anything else, or if they were really not mobile in any way, they found ways to help them be included in the activities. So I do feel that they have awareness and that they're learning and that they're benefiting from being part of the school system.
I just have one other.
Yes, please. Yeah.
So does the do the state and federal funds that already go to regular students, and I don't know the right way to say that, but non-disabled students, does that money apply also in addition to the $30,000 floor, or is that part of the $30,000 floor?
It would be part of the $30,000 floor.
Okay, and would that typically be how much then? Is it somewhere 10? They get 1.5 times, is that right?
Two.
Mm-hmm. So what would that be? What would that make up of the 30,000 then? 20,000? 21,000?
I'd have to look that up. I don't have that at my fingertips.
It would be about $13,000, I think. Rough numbers around $13,000. $6,500 is rough numbers what we've been doing now. Every year, we're talking about the dollars from the state school fund.
Yeah, I'm looking at the total amount of dollars going to each student in the school, federal and state.
Do you have that number? Dave?
I'm afraid I don't have that number. I can look that up for you.
Okay. Yeah, there are a number of reports that do contain all those numbers. Yeah. The problem for some of us who've been here a while is that it keeps changing, and we can't remember the new ones.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.
All right. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for
coming
and presenting your testimony. Great to see you back.
Thank you. See you too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also have John Hayes from the Forest Grove School Board. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on these two bills? I don't see anyone. Okay. Oh, he's got a thing, doesn't he? That's your thing. Oh, you want to talk. Okay. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the House, thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is John Hayes. I'm the chair of the Forest Grove School District School Board, and I have written testimony that I've provided to you. It's being passed around. I had the privilege of serving on the task force on school funding last year, and it was during the course of that I found out that Forest Grove ranked number one of all 197 districts in terms of per capita impact of the high cost disability funding. And it was astounding to me what it cost Forest Grove. And I would just draw your attention to that chart in my testimony there that actually tells you what the impact is. And you can see in the column, the next to the last column, the $732 figure, that's what it costs Forest Grove to cover high-cost disability that is not reimbursed by the state. So for every student, for all 6,000 students in the district, we're taking $732 away from them and putting it towards high-cost disability. So Forest Grove is a high-poverty district and has a large population of ELL students. And what we're doing, in effect, is taking money away from the support of those kids and putting it towards high-cost disability. One of the things that we have been trying to figure out is why Forest Grove ranks number one. In fact, we looked back over the last 5 or 6 years, and we are first every year except for one in terms of per capita impact. And I just wanted to share with you a couple of things that Forest Grove does. First of all, we have an extraordinarily strong special education team, and we are very, very thorough in making sure that kids who deserve and need special education are included and get that special education. We also have other programs. We have CBAP, the community-based activity program, which is a summer program which mixes disabled kids with other kids, and they participate in 6 weeks of field trips to the coast, to OMSI, all over the place. It does not cost the disabled kids anything. The other kids pay $650. My daughter has participated in that, and she loves it, and we are glad to pay the money that it takes to send her to that. We have Adventures Without Limits, which is another program that was started in our district, which takes disabled kids on trips such as kayaking and all sorts of things. They take them to Trailblazers games, all sorts of things. We have Project Unify, which is a sports program where kids who are disabled play right alongside with kids who are not disabled. We fully believe that kids move into our district because of the strong support for kids who are special education. And we also know that some kids from surrounding districts transfer in to our district because of that strong support. And I would just mention one other thing about the funding, and it's in relation to House Bill 2883, which the Forest Grove School District strongly, I don't know exactly how to say it, but we do not like it, let's put it that way. It raises the floor to $40,000, and as was just discussed, we get a double special education reimbursement for all of these high-cost disability students, and that amount is a little over $13,000, has been discussed. So the unfunded amount in the donut hole between the double sped weighting and the $40,000 is $26,000. It's over $26,000. And if Forest Grove got 100% reimbursement for high-cost disability students above $40,000, but yet had the threshold of $40,000, it would cost us more money than it's costing us right now. So this does not help Forest Grove. In the high-cost disability, when the task force on school funding discussed high-cost disability, there was some question about richer districts getting richer, sort of the Harvard University effect. And that is not the case. If you look at the table again, you'll see that Forest Grove, of the top 10 districts that this affects on a per capita basis, is the largest of the districts at 5,900 students, and all the rest are smaller. So you can see what would happen to their cost per capita under the last column at 80%, and you can see that it drops some, but it doesn't drop by a huge amount, as it turns out. And that's because of that donut hole. So what I'm asking you is, please don't increase the donut hole. Please leave the threshold at $30,000. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Dave, do you want to go through your PowerPoint?
Yes, sir.
And I will note before, as we take down his material, that on the back of the first page, on the back page of his material, it indicate that the special ed weighting was $13,600. So I was only off by $600 from memory. That's not too bad. Dave, go ahead.
So to understand what Senator Gelser and Representative McLean and Forest Grove representative talked about, I have a little background information for you. So to refresh your memory about how formula money is distributed, so we're talking about this red part, high cost disabilities grant, and it's distributed back to school districts. So how does high-cost disabilities account or grant work? Again, as you heard, the current law limits the high-cost disabilities grant to $18 million. But how it works is this. The current law on high-cost disabilities grant states that a student with approved disabilities costs above $30,000. So this is the threshold. The grant is the total cost minus $30,000. So that's per each student. Then the district grant is the sum of all these grants to each eligible students. The total grant, again, is limited to $18 million per year, the current law. If the grant total of the grants initially exceeds this amount, then grants to all school districts are reduced proportionately. So at this point, with 42 million claims, we have only 18 million available. So reimbursement rate is 42%. So here's a little history about high-cost disabilities grant. So the inception was 2003-04 school year. So start with 71 cents per dollar claimed reimbursement rate. There were a couple of changes in the past on high-cost disabilities grant. So 2005 and 2006, the threshold went up to 30,000. And if you see the claims, it declined. It had to decline. Of course, then the reimbursement rate went up a little. Now, another change was in 2007 and 8 school year. The legislature increased the grant to $18 million. That increased reimbursement rate. Since then, there has been no change. And then the most recent estimate is 13-14. This number was out April of 2014. So at about April somewhere, we're going to anticipate 14-15 estimated cost. So with 42 million claims, grant is limited to 18, so reimbursement rate is 42 cents per dollar claimed. And for the school year 2013-14, 93 school districts, large and small, are expected to receive high-cost disabilities grant. And if you click on this link, you see all the school districts that are receiving high-cost disabilities grant. So this is the list. And you can look up your districts and others. And so a little background. So back to the bills. 2927 actually increases the grant to $36 million. But 2883 also increases the threshold to 40,000. Now, based on a preliminary estimate that Mike Wiltfong at ODE worked on, raising threshold to 40,000, and then increasing the grant amount to $36 million per year, we're going to leave out about 1,100 students out. There's a donut hole between 30,000 and 40,000. That's going to have big impact because we're losing a little over 1,000 students. And then reimbursement rate actually increases to over 100%, meaning we fully reimburse all the cost, but there'll be money left over. So there's a difference between the two bills. As a little side note, co-chair's budget framework has a little different figure than $36 million.
And what is their number?
Yeah. That's
$35 million?
Yes.
Is their
per
number?
Year, yes.
Okay. All right. Questions for Day. Before we close the hearing, I'd like to make a couple of comments that occurred to me partly here and partly historical. When I was on the Eugene School Board from 1994 until 2001, this concept was the first bill that I came to Salem to lobby for, because Eugene at that time had one student who, because of severe medical problem, fragilities, cost the district $180,000 in 1 year. And that was before any of this went into effect. So I had a personal interest, or I should say an interest as a member of a school board in getting this. The key comment I want to make is that if you look at this list that we just got from the department, there are a whole lot of school districts where the current count is zero, and a whole bunch of others where the number is significant, is high at least more than one, or even in some very small districts, like Harney County, School District Number 4, there's one person, but the number of students in that district, I suspect, is very small. So this is one of those situations, one of those things where any school district at any time could have its budget wrecked by one high-cost student or a few high-cost students. That as a luck of the draw, as it were, and then in a few other years they might not have anybody in this category. So it's not really possible to tell where the benefits or detriments of this policy are by looking at these numbers, because they're going to change over time in the various districts, with the possible exception of Forest Grove that we heard from, because of the reality that they have a particularly good program, at least as it was pointed out to us. The other thing I wanted to note was that at this $30,000 threshold, the district is already paying $84 million. The districts, plural, are already paying $84,120,000 just to reach the $30,000 threshold at 2,804 students. So, in other words, we're giving them $18 million currently, but they're paying $84 million up front. Of that, of course, we pay $13,600 toward their formula funds. So even with this change, even if we approve this change, the districts will still be paying the lion's share of the cost for these high cost students, and at least a very significant portion of that falls outside of their formula funds. I hope that's clearer than mud. Representative Whitsitt?
Do the schools have a choice to participate in this or not participate? Is this isn't all the districts in the state, is it, that are up there, or is it?
The district, all of the districts in the state are in this list.
Okay.
But
okay,
if you'll notice the zeros in
right.
the third column,
yes, right.
those are the ones that don't have a student who qualifies.
Right.
They don't have a student who spend more than
okay.
$30,000
okay,
on.
There we go. Okay. It's
got to be over.
Yes, Representative Leininger.
So, you know, Lake Oswego gets a significant amount of money through this, and I also think it's a really important program. But one of the things that occurred to me as we were having question and answers is the amount of money that a district gets through this program at all related to their ability to, you know, classify and then actively seek, you know, reimbursement? Because I know with some of the grant programs that we run, it's hard because district's ability to tap that funding in some measure is connected to their ability to go after grants well as much as it is their eligibility. And I hope we're not creating a situation where no, districts that have a lot of need but may not have a lot of capacity to go after grants get less, and those like, you know, one of my jurisdictions that has high capacity to go after grants gets disproportionately high amount just because they're quite good at going after grants.
So while I asked if we had any other witnesses, your question prompted a couple more. Gentlemen, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Green on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. I brought Michael Wiltfong up with me, who you see his name at the bottom of that. He is the director of school finance and pupil transportation. Is it school finance? What is it?
That's my boss.
Oh, your boss. Sorry, Michael. I'm sorry.
I'm Michael Elliott. I'm Michael Elliott, school fund coordinator, and I'm in charge of managing the high-cost disability grant.
So to answer your question, Representative, this is not a grant where you have to fill out a grant application and show what you're going to do student achievement-wise.
No.
You literally send a form in electronically to Michael and his shop that says, did you spend more than $30,000 a year on special ed for one student? If you did, you are put into the list of schools that are picked, and it's a reimbursement. Remember, you've been told it's a reimbursement. So depending on how many students statewide put in for that depends on the replacement ratio or reimbursement ratio, for lack of a better term, because it's money already spent by the school district. So it's not that formalistic grant for like a teacher quality network grant. It's literally, did you spend more than $30,000 on an IEP student? and how much did you spend above that? And then you transmit those forms. Sorry, I put you in Michael Wilpong's position. Michael Elliott here, and they review those. And just general testimony, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Normally, the Oregon School Boards Association doesn't support carve-outs out of the state school fund. This is a carve-out we do support because, as I think you've seen from this list, if, in fact, you get a district, and I think Mr. Hayes from Forest Grove showed you a chart, one of our member school districts was on that list, and it's called Long Creek, and yes, you call it Creek out there. It's Long Creek. It's not Long Creek. They had one student. And they have 35 kids in their entire school district. So you can see in some of our very small districts, the ones that Representative Bence has throughout his district, yeah. They get one student in there. It can really be a budget buster. I happen to be around in 2003 when this was created. And essentially we created it as an insurance policy against this type of thing happening to school districts, where students, because they are guaranteed a federally free appropriate public education, they need all the services that are going to be developed on their IEP, and you could bring in a student that costs an extraordinarily high amount of money, and a district would say, what do we do? The legislature in 2003 created this, for lack of a better term, an insurance policy. And the co-chairs this time have funded this at $35 million a year, so $70 million out of the biennium. Again, we normally haven't supported carve-outs. We are supportive of this. This was the one item, by the way, that the State School Fund Task Force supported when they looked at everything dealing with the funding formula. It was to increase this because, as you saw, historically, we've had more students qualify for this. And that's because we're doing a better job at identifying students. We're doing a better job at providing services to students. I'd also note that you're looking at testimony right now from the Salem-Keizer School District. I'm also a member of that school board. And we are very supportive of this as a school district. We made a request, I think it was in the neighborhood of $12.5 million on behalf of Salem-Keizer because of the types and numbers of students we see. We got that replaced at 42% as a reimbursement. You could take the second largest school district, Salem-Keizer, or you could go out to Long Creek and take a look at one of our smaller school districts. These students show up all the time, and it is an insurance policy to help school districts meet these extraordinarily high costs.
Is that helpful? Yeah. Yes.
That's extremely helpful. I agree with you. I generally am concerned about carve-outs, but to hear you say that you support this and the reasons why answers my question. Thanks.
Representative,
what's it? So I'm concerned about some of these districts that it says zero. That does not mean that there aren't students, I am sure, in those districts that meet the criteria. So what are those districts doing then that it shows up as zero on there?
So, Ms. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, you could have a variety of factors that have a school district put in zero. They may not have a student that cost for their educational program to be over $30,000. If you look at some of those districts, I'm pretty sure a lot of them don't have it. Some of them also may not put in for the grant. They may just not put in.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Why would they not?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, one of these restrictions on the grant is if you're receiving money from other sources, you cannot then also apply for the grant. So, for example, if you're getting Medicaid for this student or the student is in other programs such that other money is funding that student, then we don't double dip. We don't get to that account. So if, for example, let's say the student costs absolute dollars of $50,000, but Medicaid's covering $25,000 to $30,000 of that, they then can't say you don't get to count that. So then it would be only they're only spending, you know, $15,000, $20,000 on the student, and that wouldn't meet the threshold.
Yes, please.
That is what I was looking for when I was asking about the amount of money spent, both federal and state, on that $30,000, because I know a lot of them are using, they're getting the Medicaid money. So that really isn't part of the $30,000 then.
And
as a base.
Ms. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, school districts are very aggressive and very creative in ways to try to pay for programs that cost over $30,000. There are some instances, in some cases, depending on the type of service, type of disability, what the parents have asked for, the parents' insurance may also pay a portion of that. So it's being creative, it's being aggressive, it's ensuring that whatever program is necessary for that student to meet their IEP goals that's drafted up, the district will go after those funds. Also, I'll be real honest with you, we have some districts where you may have a new business manager or a new special ed director who has not seen this before, and they may not know to apply for it. That's very unlikely, but I'm not saying that doesn't occur.
Yeah, please, yes. Follow up.
Mm-hmm. What is the, does the Social Security disability vary by the disability of the student that the school is getting that we're talking about here? I'm trying to establish what kind of money is going into these districts that have zero up there, but the federal money is through disability. What is that, 800 and something a month? Or
so,
what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, I don't have those numbers at my fingertip. I know they have to be eligible, number one.
Right,
they have
right.
to meet the qualifications. They have to meet eligibility. And then services provided must be eligible as well for Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement. So it depends on type of services, whether the individual and or the family qualify for those funds. Right. But there are a variety of ways in which those funds are accessed.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Yes. Oh, yes. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a little bit of a connection to Representative Whitsitt's question, so how, what kind of verification do you have to, since you administer it, I would imagine, you know, do they have to submit receipts, budget lines? Do we take them at their word? Are they audited periodically?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, as far as this grant specifically, there is not a lot of verification. However, there's a catch for this grant, and that's called maintenance of effort, which is a federal program which requires a district to spend at least as much on special education this year as they did last year. They have to maintain their effort in order to maintain eligibility for federal Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. So that helps us compare costs, and we look at that to make sure that their costs still track and that the costs track per student. Frequently when I get the data, I will review it and I'll say, okay, what were your costs per student last year? What are they this year? And if you've dropped like $15,000 in cost per student, so you've dropped a lot of money in reimbursables or added a lot of money, I call up the district and start finding out why there are those significant changes to make sure. But then again, their maintenance of effort requirements also are a way to ensure that they're accurately reporting, because there are significant penalties if they do not maintain effort. They could basically, they have to repay federal funds with state dollars. They cannot repay federal funds with other federal funds.
How many states
okay.
do you have?
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question, one comment, but to represent I know that in our district we have a number of high-need students, but for whatever reason they don't reach that $30,000 threshold. Because we have an entire section of one of our schools that is the set-aside, car, you know, it's a specially equipped room for those type of students that require, you know, special care and so forth. So my question is for the department, that this is separate from the actual SPED money. That also is a percentage, you know, that ODE also reimburses for up to, what, 12% of identified? That's a different pot of money, correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, yes. So this is, it's kind of like it comes off the top to come around and come in at the bottom. And in between there is the formula dollars for special education.
Right.
And the formula dollars are the first weight for general education, then an additional weight. And that additional weight is funded up to 11% of the school district's ADMR. Yeah. ADMR is average daily membership resident. It's how we count students for funding purposes. So, for example, if you have a district that has 1,000 ADMR, the first 110 students eligible for special education are going to get the second weight. The 111th to X, to whatever that is, they will not get the second weight. But that money then is part of the general fund, goes to fund special education. That's what people are discussing when they talk about the donut holes. You get the first $13,600 in funding for special education. Then the district has to come up with additional funding to pay for the needs of the students up to $30,000, and then every single dollar over $30,000 is eligible for reimbursement. The problem is, if Representative Johnson's school district has $1 worth of eligible expenses, I'm paying him 42 cents.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to get that on the record, Mr. Chair. There's another formula for weighting of SPED students that's apart from this pot of money as well. So it's fairly complicated, but there's a lot of different little sources of benefits that are going out there to try to help districts meet the needs.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to follow up on that, and yet, or also, we do not require, as with all the my understanding of the school funding formula, we do not require schools to spend that extra weight on special ed necessarily, just like we don't require them to spend the ELL, any of that. We, it is given based on their numbers, yet we don't say, okay, now show us exactly how you're funding it. That's, is that correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, that is correct. There is no state requirement to fund the money or to spend the money on a specific program. There is, of course, the federal maintenance of effort requirements and that sort of thing.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith-Warner, remember, it's a distribution formula, right, not a spending not a formula. Spending. It's out there to recognize averages across the state, and it takes that. We're hoping for a little bit more than the co-chairs and $7.2 billion, but it takes that pot of money and shoves it out to 197 school districts, and it's recognized to be a distribution formula, not a spending formula. The one caveat in special ed law is the one that Michael mentioned earlier, which is the federal requirement for maintenance of effort. You must spend equal to, with some exceptions, your audited data to the Federal Department of Education for special education.
Which, if I could just say briefly, which to me, the interesting thing about that is these small districts where there's one student. Maybe there's been one student in for 12 years, and then that student's gone.
And, Ms. Chairman, Representative Smith-Warner, that is one of the exceptions.
Okay,
if you lose student count,
right,
they can recognize that in the maintenance of effort. The other is expenditure on physical facilities. If you did a one-time expenditure on physical facilities related to special ed, you can put that in your data to show it was a one-time expenditure related to facilities for students with special education needs.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, I'm frequently asked by the independent auditors, the CPAs, the district is reporting this student at this year for this much. Can you verify that? And I will verify for them so that they can then say, oh, I have the exception or I meet whatever maintenance of effort requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My ending statement seldom results in this much additional discussion, but I think it was useful today. Mm-hmm. Anything else for these two? Thank you.
Thank you.
Having energized the room, is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill? Oh, these two bills. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2883 and House Bill 2927 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2859.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go right to
it. Sorry?
I'm happy to go right to
it. Sure, if you want to, yeah, that'd be great. Representative Reed. Oh, wait a minute. First, we'll have an introduction of the bill while you move.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sitting in for Chris today on this bill. And this measure would reduce the tax rate applicable to any income earned by a benefit company if the company is subject to personal income taxes. For example, LLCs are subject to personal income taxes. The applicable rate is either 8% or the existing marginal tax rate, whichever is lower. If it's subject to the corporation tax rate, for like C corporations, for example, the applicable tax rate is reduced from the current tax rates of 6.6% and 7.6% to tax rates of 5.6% and 6.6%. And a benefit company is a relatively new corporate status. It's intended to include positive impacts on society and the environment when executing the fiduciary obligation of earning a profit. And so this status would include corporations and LLCs. Having the status of a benefit company only affects the requirements of corporate purpose, accountability, and transparency. And to date, there's been no difference in taxation, but this bill would create a difference in taxation as well.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I wanted to give you a little history or reflection on the history of benefit companies and explain why I think this is a worthwhile conversation. You may remember, most of you at least, the 2013 session, we passed House Bill 2296. I keep looking down at it to make sure I have it right, that created the concept of a benefit company. And the idea was that we wanted to allow people to bring the values to work. At least that was my idea, that part of being a profitable business and a successful business over the long term is paying attention to the effects of your decisions on your employees, on the community, on the environment, and those sorts of things. And I think that's it's been a successful thing thus far, and that companies want to take advantage of that and are choosing to organize themselves that way in order to make a clear statement about their intentions and to make it clear to those who choose to invest or participate in the operations of their company. Now, juxtapose that against what I think all of us recognize in this state around the challenges of starting businesses, around access to capital for small and growing businesses. And I think this concept gives us a chance to inject that same sort of recognition amongst the sorts of businesses that are trying to grow and succeed. So it is not, I think, a finished product. I think there's good discussion to have here, but it particularly amidst the other kinds of tax reform discussions that are always present, and of course I hope continue to pick up steam, I think this is a worthwhile discussion to have as a way of continuing to bring our values to the tax structure, and particularly as it relates to growth businesses and entrepreneurs. So I appreciate your hearing the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Reed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, please. Representative Leininger, you almost got away.
Okay. No problem.
So I want to say first that I really appreciate your commitment to creative thinking and looking for opportunities to find ways to spur us forward in terms of job creation and creating innovative new businesses. So I think that's great. I'm really intrigued by this model, and I have a lot to learn, and I'm glad to hear you describe it as something where we're in the middle of a conversation, and that's great. And one thing I'm wondering is, do you have a sense of what the fiscal impact would be if this were to become law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, no, I don't think so, because for a number of reasons. One, the first is that a company does not have to be a benefit company. That's entirely their choice. They can choose that, and the bill that we passed goes into considerable detail about how that choice might be made, and similarly, how a business might choose to move away from that status. Secondly, of course, as you and the rest of the committee know very well, the predictions of corporate income are not very accurate. The standard deviation, as I remember, I just got an update from Dr. Warner now with respect to the kicker, is standard deviation is 29%. So I think that's pretty hard. And thirdly, this has an element of capital gains, which is even more unpredictable. So I think if we decide to go forward with this, I'll be very interested to see how Christine and others create a revenue impact statement. I don't have one.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Thank you. Oh, Representative Whitsitt.
You've energized the committee, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yes. Just sit there long enough and you will do that.
We're traveled down
here. No problem. Yeah.
I've forgotten. Could you describe what it takes to describe yourself as a benefit company?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, yes. It essentially is a matter of making a statement that you are, and I'm stalling for a moment to make sure that I have the right, here it is, on page one of the bill. General public benefit means a material positive impact on society and the environment taken as a whole from the business and operations of a benefit company. The bill goes on to describe how that works, and it requires a benefit company to adopt a third-party standard, which, again, the definition says means a recognized standard for defining, reporting, and assessing an entity's social and environmental performance. That, and it goes on to for a bunch of more description. It requires the benefit company to make a report that assesses itself against that third-party standard that they select, and to make that report publicly available, I think annually, although that's at another part of the bill, so I don't have that in front of me at the moment.
So follow
yes,
up.
Please.
So probably the key term in there is material.
Yes.
Okay. So that's a measurable, quantifiable material, meaning not esoteric somehow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, that's what I would say, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bill Cross, Jim Brennan, and Jan Green, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name for the record is Bill Cross. I'm representing Willamette Valley Vineyards, and I'm really here to introduce Jim Bruneau, the founder, and Jan Green, who's involved in the operations of the company, to talk a little bit about benefit companies. I'm also have been, you know, doing some research and working with them. But I'm really more the pretty face at today's presentation, so I'll turn it over to Jim.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much for hearing this bill. My name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards. And in large part, a result of the legislative actions that have taken place over the last 35 years by this Oregon legislature that has led to the industry that I have the pleasure of working in today. You know, back many, many years ago, it was 35 years ago, we actually came before the legislature and asked you to consider something, a change in the policy, the tax policy that affected our industry, to make a modest tax credit for small producers that would give small wine entrepreneurs and winemakers an opportunity to get going in Oregon. And back then, lawmakers made a judgment that this was a strategy worth pursuing. And that very modest change in tax policy has sent a very powerful message that has resulted in large part to a remarkable change in our economy, of which many of you have seen. I think now we have well over 600 wineries in Oregon. And when we started with the change in the law, there was a handful. So part of the reason why we're here to talk to you about this is that this policy, this benefit company policy, is a very powerful and important policy. It makes businesses take an option of thinking not just what the bottom line is, but their impact on the community, on the environment, and on their employees, all stakeholders. And this actually produces a great public benefit because a lot less public resources are required to deal with the costs that businesses are not internalizing in their conduct. So this is a very valuable public policy. Imagine if Oregon was the first state to say, we welcome businesses who think this way, and we want to treat them in this manner, even though this is a modest proposal we're making to you. I wanted to tell you about the challenge we have at Willamette Valley Vineyards. We want to be one of these companies. And the way that the law works, a majority of the equity holders can make a decision. And most companies, most benefit companies, those equity holders would fit around a table about this size. But when I came before you and asked for the changes in the law so many years ago to start an industry, I worked my way through college in a sawmill in Roseburg, Oregon. I didn't have the money to actually grow the business. And so what I did was something very unusual. I did the nation's first self-underwritten public common stock offering. There was possible for us to do that in Oregon. And so I went out, and we now have 5,000 shareholders in Willamette Valley Vineyards. But under the law, I have to figure out a way of not only amongst ourselves deciding this is a great strategy and something we should do, but I have to go and get a 2/3 vote of all those qualified and able to vote to support this, to become a benefit company. So I thought, Bill, how are we going to do this? We need to be able to show investors who are thinking in a very linear way now. Remember, this company is over 25 years old, and this stock is now owned by people who make pure financial decisions and by financial advisors who judge each other against the financial return they provide to the people that they're counseling. And so what message can we send to them that this is a wise thing for them to support? And we thought this would be a great way to do that. Oregon is indeed open for business for this kind of thinking. So, you know, Jan here has been working with how we would meet the specific criteria of becoming a benefit company. And she can deal actually and answer some of the specific questions about, for example, paid maternity leave is one of the standards for which we get points for, as an example, which, as you know, is a significant benefit to the community. Anyway, I really appreciate the time you've given. I did provide you with our tax history. We're publicly held, as you know, and so this is no secret. I provided our tax history since 1995 through 2013. And if you have an opportunity to look at that, and I don't know if you've had, but you could, this one thing that might make you at least think is to go to the 2013, go to all the way to the end of this spreadsheet, and you can see what our cumulative revenue has been since I started Willamette Valley Vineyards. You can see what our federal taxes are, our state taxes are, our total taxes against the net income that we've earned. And if you look on this spreadsheet, you'll see that we've earned, our shareholders are doing okay after all this work and this many years. Our shareholders have earned a little over $10 million in net income. But we have paid, as an Oregon business, $12.7 million in total state and federal taxes. And that doesn't include payroll taxes. This is just excise taxes, income taxes, property taxes, and fees. So I wanted you to understand and put that in perspective about what our present tax situation is.
Yes, ma'am.
Want me to talk about some of the, I'm Jan Green, and I'm a facilities manager, and I work with all the shareholders at Willamette Valley Vineyards, so I have an idea of how difficult it would be to get 5,000 people to vote. We barely make quorum every year, which is just over 50% of our votes, so that would be one challenge that Jim spoke about. This is a copy of the assessment that you fill out if you decide you want to be a B corporation, and some of the things that you need to prove in writing a document to the third-party assessment company, which we've been dealing with B Lab. It's not like you have to do every single thing in there. It's weighted, so you get points, and you have to get 80 points total for this. So it's things like providing on-site childcare, increasing benefits, pay, like Jim said, paid maternity leave, creating written KPIs, not only for the company, but all of our key suppliers. So in other words, we would only deal with suppliers who are willing to be green-focused, sustainably-focused, and who take really good care of their employees as well, which is time-consuming, and it's, you know, dealing with people. Some of the people we get are cork from Portugal, so how do you go through that whole chain and make sure that every company we're dealing with has the same goals as we do? One of the things you get extra points for is having all your products be cradle to cradle. And we work really hard to do that now, but it's, again, taking it one step further in pretty much everything we do. What kind of questions do you have?
Thank you. We'll consider that invitation to the panel. questions for this panel.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes, Bill.
Committee members, just to respond to the question earlier about the revenue impact of this proposal.
Yes.
It won't be very significant because there aren't that many benefit companies in Oregon. But what would be wonderful is the day it does become significant, because that would mean the policy is working and we're attracting additional benefit companies and or converting, you know, companies into this kind of operation. And when you look at what benefit companies provide and partner with local and state governments in terms of their sustainability, their community involvement, their social responsibilities, it's a factor in terms of our cost of government and providing those services. And so they could be viewed as a partner. So to the degree that initially I think the significance would be nominal, I mean the impact would be nominal, it would be exciting if 10 years from now we had 10,000 benefit companies instead of the 300 or 400 that we have today.
Thank you. Representative Bence and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept's a really interesting one, but the way that our systems work, and it's become more apparent over the years I've spent on this committee, is that you have a point of reference, like profit is a pretty good point of reference, and then you build your tax system away from that. This came up the other day as we talked about minimum tax. And the underlying theme that is around when you put together a C Corp is that it will go out and operate as that C Corp, and it will enjoy a number of benefits like deductions and other things that we put in place in the hopes that it will throw off the tax revenue you have up there. I know I'm stating the obvious, but as Representative Reed mentioned, the challenge of fitting in this particular set of activities to an already existing structure that gives corporations the opportunities to do what you want to do, but through in a way that doesn't reduce the income tax that you're paying based upon a haystack of other arrangements that are designed to generate certain outcomes. It's really complicated. And so when I saw this first, I thought, well, good idea, but it looked almost as though we would allow every corporation to become a little miniature legislature and, again, make these decisions on what all these public goods might be, which is the job we're supposed to be doing somehow. But what we would do instead, if we followed this particular approach, we might say that the people who are running the corporation within the tightly designed framework that you're working on, and that President Whitson mentioned, would be allowed to do a certain amount of good. How much good? Would it be deductible? Is it being? Are the dollars that are being spent on it being earned under the umbrella, if you will, of the C corporation structure? And the answer, of course, is yes. And so, if we were going to further review this particular piece of legislation, it would take an enormous amount of work, at least on my part, to understand how the good that you choose to do fits into all the other things we've tried to incent with all of the multitude of other devices we put into our tax system. So having said all that, give me a snappy little answer that clears it all up.
Long answer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bence, you have asked a very good question, and it's something that we need to take a little time to think about how we answer it and address it. We do think that the general idea of the Oregon legislature showing Oregon businesses that this is a powerful way to go, and to show investors this is a powerful way to go, we think has value, because we think it produces more net benefit to the general public and to our employees.
Follow up? Yeah.
It may well do so. The challenge would be in our figuring out how it damaged the income that you're paying in the form of tax.
Right.
And doing all of the balancing and weighing and everything else we do on our tax credit committee, for example, in trying to determine that cost-benefit thing, and how one would predict this, I do not know. But that would be one of the questions that would have to be really clearly answered very, very clearly to move forward on this concept.
In cases that I've encountered over the years, one of the ways to deal with a level of uncertainty is to limit its level of uncertainty. And I've seen, for example, when the legislature adopted the small producer tax credit, they actually established a dollar amount on the credit. And so they knew what their actual exposure was. What turned out was the industry, as a result of the incentive, grew so far past the tax revenue that the state was receiving that it became a net benefit to the state.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, thanks for being here today, and thanks for you and your and the Willamette Valley Vineyards contribution to the winery industry in Oregon. It's been significant. I wanted to ask about the third-party certification process. First of all, who are these third parties that make the determination of if, in fact, you would be a benefit company? And then the specifics upon what that standard is graded upon. There's some bullets on the page here that say, the third-party standard is a recognized standard for defining, reporting, and assessing a business's social and environmental performance by assessing the employees and workforce of the businesses, its subsidiaries and suppliers, the interests of customers and beneficiaries of the business, and then the community and societal factors, including those of each community in which offices or facilities of the business or its subsidiaries or its suppliers. Is that it, or are there more detailed or sub-bullets to those three that are listed?
It's a voluminous assessment.
Okay, I thought it probably was.
And I have it right here.
Chair, may I break in there just to suggest that is one of the options. It's not the only one. That there are a variety of choices that one could make, but that's B-Lab, I think.
B-Lab.
That's B-Lab.
Yeah, they're very rigorous.
And B-Lab would be one of these third-party certifications?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was a question. How many of them are there out there that you can choose from?
I don't know how many. I understand there are others, but
I think you'll have somebody up here who will be able to answer.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Are we specifically just talking about Oregon third-party certifications, or are these broader than Oregon? Okay. Thank you.
All right. I might note that there is a document that was sent that was included in our notes from a group which included Metropolitan Group, Equilibrium Group, Celilo Group Media, and B-Lab. So that's among the documents that we have. anything else for this panel? Thank you so much for coming today and for presenting your testimony. I will tell you that I have been to your facility a number of times. I've enjoyed your wine and the tour that you provided last time I was there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Philkel?
Tasting room.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2859? Hello.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office. Mostly I wanted to make myself available. Benefit companies is a new statute. It went into effect last January of 2014. And so there's still a bit of a confusion education, and I wanted to make myself available to the committee if you had any questions about what our process is, how you become one, how we've been implementing the law. I did work with the Oregon Lawyers Group in drafting the bill back in 2012. And worked with Representative Reed as the bill was moving through the 2013 session. So Oregon currently has about just a little over 400 benefit companies. We're actually adding about 60 new companies per month. Added benefit companies to our online system, so we're trying to make it as easy as possible if you want to become a benefit company, but those are mostly new companies coming in. If you're an existing company, and there's about a little over 200,000 of those, you can amend your articles of incorporation or organization to add in the language to say that you're subject to Oregon statute around benefit companies. Just to clear up a little bit of some of the earlier communication, we have, on the one hand, a third-party standard, which is B-Labs, or B-Corp certification. They were the group, the nonprofit, that actually drafted model legislation that's been passed in 29 states. Oregon took that, and the lawyer group amended it to fit more with Oregon statutes and how we do business here. When you become a benefit company under Chapter 60 in Oregon law, we would refer to you as a statutory benefit company. And I think, as Representative Reed talked about, one of the things that does is it provides better fiduciary responsibility or accountability for that business that they can pursue social and environmental benefits in addition to profits. So it's that triple bottom line, and it provides more of the legal cover for the owners of the company and the directors and the people that are running it to be able to do that, as opposed to just solely maximizing profit.
Questions? Yes.
So,
Representative Whitsitt.
In Oregon, there are about 720 new companies a year coming under this designation. Is that what you said? 60 a month?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. We added the option in our online system at the end of October, and so since then we've been getting about 60 a month, but the first 9 months we had roughly about 60. We were only getting about 5 a month, just because so many new businesses, the majority of our businesses register with us online, so we'd kind of excluded benefit or potential benefit companies from the process, so we may wind up with that. What was the number?
720 if you're doing 60
times 12.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, if that remains consistent, I would say that that's just under the current statute, where there's no additional benefit that a regular or a different company would get from the state. I would say that's the trend, and we would probably be adding around that number per year.
So,
yes, please.
So we don't have any idea yet what the revenue impact is from these companies that are having this reduced tax.
Of course, we don't have a reduced tax rate yet. This bill would propose that.
Right, but if you've got these companies and if we pass this bill, what have you figured out what that's going to be? I mean,
we have not.
That's kind of your question.
Yeah, we'd first have to know what's the taxable income that would be subject to the bill and how many companies did it apply to, and that's not anything that we've looked at.
May I suggest maybe that's something that you should be looking at before you pass the bill, would be what the impact is to the state.
Right. I will note that the Secretary of State's office is neutral on the bill.
Right.
They're not taking a position on the bill.
But revenue
and
department.
The Legislative Revenue Office, if we pursue this bill, the Legislative Revenue Office will make an estimate of what the revenue impact will be.
Okay, before we would vote on it. Okay.
Yes.
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Right, yes. Representative Reed, please.
Thanks. Can you shed any more light on what those businesses are, how they might be described? Are there particular industries that are more common? Are they large or small? Or I'm guessing of the 60 that maybe 58 of them are not making any money yet, but maybe I'm wrong.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed. So the 60 that we're getting a month, these are brand new companies that are just coming in. So they're just now forming. They may have been general partners or sole proprietors in the past, but the majority of them are coming in. They're registering as limited liability companies, so which essentially is a partnership. It tends to be small. Just by the nature of Oregon companies, about 98% are what we would classify as small business to begin with. We are very much a small business state. I'm not aware of the 400 that we actually have any of the publicly traded companies that have that higher opt-in threshold, which is that two-thirds majority. The vast majority of the companies that are coming in and they're registering are smaller. They're not publicly traded, so they just have a simple majority either to come in and opt in to become a benefit company or to opt out, and that was by design. Most states require at least a two-thirds majority in all cases. Oregon, we just wanted to make it as simple as possible, so if the majority of the owners of the company wanted to become a benefit company, they had that option.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks very much for your testimony. What's the selection criteria for the third-party validation? I just was on your FAQ on the website, and it links to benefitcompany.net, I think, which has about 10 third-party standards, but is the Secretary of State's office the one that validates the list of third-party standards?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, we do not have that role. That is in statute. Basically, the statute outlined a number of things that a valid third-party standard was required. It had to be transparent, so their information had to be available online. A company doesn't actually have to engage with that third-party standard. So if my company wanted to become an Oregon benefit company, I wouldn't have to pay the $2,500 to B Labs for their certification, but I'd their standard had to be available so that I could download it, I could fill out, I could benchmark myself or my company's performance against that. I can't choose a standard that is not impartial, so I can't be on, I can't serve on their board. There has to be a separation there. Off the top of my head, I can't think of what the other ones were, but primarily it's just in the statute is where that requirement comes in. Because Oregon wasn't providing any additional tangible benefits from the government to these companies, it was mostly a matter of sort of the internal operations of the company and their responsibilities to their shareholders, their stakeholders, and employees and vendors. We'd had to, in the work group, we had the discussions, should there be some regulatory requirement, like a nonprofit charity has to file annual reports with the Department of Justice. Given that there weren't any other benefits, that didn't make a lot of sense to set additional requirements, additional regulatory hurdles, or those sorts of things into the law. This is really a matter of, as we saw it, giving businesses back that freedom that they used to have prior to a couple of court decisions in the mid-1980s, that once those happened that said corporations had to maximize shareholder equity, all the attorneys across the country started advising their clients that, well, you might be able to do those other benefits and try to be good for the environment, but you're probably going to lose at court, and you'll not only lose corporately, you'll lose personally. And so that was more of a chilling effect from the mid-80s. This law was really designed to kind of level that playing field back out so that instead of government telling companies how they had to operate, the companies had the freedom to do that for themselves and make that decision.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. And there, if I understand the statute correctly, there is a requirement for a yearly annual benefit report from each company, but I understand it's not actually given back to the Secretary of State. It just has to be made public on their own website.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions for the Secretary of State's office? Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I, too, as Representative Benz, have concerns that if you don't know what the effect of this is going to be, maybe you shouldn't do it. The benefit company went in just 2 years ago. We don't know what the revenue impact would probably be on a lot of these because they may not have even filed. As to the type of companies that are now listed, they range from Sweet Leaf Cannabis of Springfield, LLC, Your Dog Needs a Bow Tie, LLC, to Neil Kelly. So, you know, it's sort of all over the range. I think that given the situation of not knowing what the impact might be, it might be good to just not act on this bill until you know what the revenue would be foregone in something like this. It seems to me that it would be a creative way of eliminating capital gains tax. And I would direct you to some other people's testimony that was submitted in writing.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2859. Colleagues, I wanted to note that we expect the floor to run long on Wednesday because of the nature of the bills that are before the House. The result of that, we also had scheduled on Wednesday an agenda that would involve a number of people coming in from out of town to testify. So I've decided that the better part of valor at this point is to expect floor to run long, to plan on it, to acknowledge that today. And so what we're going to do is we're going to cancel the meeting, which is currently scheduled for Wednesday, for the Revenue Committee, we will reschedule the items that are on that agenda for another time. The people who are coming for that meeting also were coming for some other committees on the same day. When we know what day that is, we'll repost. So you know that the Wednesday meeting is canceled, and we'll see you all on the floor that day. The meeting tomorrow, however, is still on. We'll see you then, 1 o'clock tomorrow. With that, the committee is adjourned.